There were four Jewish Yiddish imamas sitting around together. They got together every week to play mahjong. And the first one comes in, you know, she puts her coat down, she puts her bag down, she sits down, she says, oh, hi. And she sits down. The next, you know, her friend sits down next to her and she says, oy vey. You know, the third one comes, she sits down, she says, oy vey's mir. And the fourth one sits down and she says, you know, guys, enough about the kids, let's just play. So, really, we do all have lots of things that we could kvetch about. Sometimes they're minute little, you know, insignificant details that kind of make our day more complicated than it needs to be, but they give us something to kvetch about. And sometimes it's more serious, dark, gloomy, you know, unpleasantness that life unfortunately or fortunately contains, and we have good reason to complain. And the thought we're really addressing tonight is, what does Judaism have to say, or what does Hasidic philosophy as a prism or a light to look through Judaism have to say about this issue of happiness that we all grapple with on different levels but throughout our life? And King David probably, you know, summed it up in you know, the shortest, most concise way in Psalms, where he says, "Ivdu et Hashem b'simcha." One must serve God with joy. And at first glance, it sounds like, okay, that's nice. Like you're telling us we should serve God with joy. But you know, second glance, you say, wait a minute. You know, it's one thing if God tells us, you know, honor your parents, or you should eat a cow instead of a pig, or you should celebrate this holiday on this time of year, or all these different things that God asks us and tells us to do. And we might say, okay, fine. But if you think about it, how dare God ask us to have a certain mood or a certain feeling? You want to tell me to do this or do that, go, you know, to location A or B or all the, that's one thing, but to tell me how I should feel or what my mood should be or my disposition, my mind frame, like, really, that's none of your business. I'm a nice person, I honor my parents, I help my neighbor, I do what I need to do, and don't tell me I should do it also with a smile on my face. Like, what kind of nerve? What kind of chutzpah? You know, I'm doing what I need to do. I also have to do it with a smile. Like, that's really just too far. And most people would be very right in saying that, because the truth isn't my mood my own business? Meaning, I'm going about, I'm conducting my day the way I'm supposed to. I go to work, I get up, I do what I need to do, I do the carpools, whatever my obligations of the day are, and I'm doing it. And really, the mood that I'm doing it in is none of anybody's business. If I woke up on the wrong side of the bed, and then when I got up, I bumped my head on the, whatever, you know, and the day started that way, it's no one's business if how I'm feeling. And for God to say, you have to serve me, not only serve me, and that's, as we know, it's not just a 12-step program, it's a 613-step program, but P.S., do it with a smile. Yeah, thank you very much. So, without waiting for, you know, the answer, I'm going to answer it right at the very beginning, because I think it's really important to kind of get to the crux of the issue before we start going anywhere else. And the answer to this question of how God could demand something about our own mood is, it's not our own business. If it was, maybe God wouldn't really mix into it. But the fact is, our own mood, and we all could probably admit in our own personal lives, that, you know, if you wake up and whatever is going on in your life is, you know, more on the dark, grumpy, moody side for very valid or maybe not such valid reasons, but regardless, how likely are you to let that person cut you, you know, in front of the street, you know, in the car? How likely are you to say to the person in the grocery store, oh, you only have two items, go in front of me? How likely are you to, you know, spend time with somebody listening to them kvetch on the phone when you're not in a good mood? Everybody knows if you're feeling down or dark or black, you don't have enough patience or time or interest or energy to exert on anybody else. And we all know that if you do wake up in a happy, cheerful, smiling mood, how likely is it that you would give someone that extra moment? Or you would smile at a random stranger just because I'm in a good mood? Or any of the other things that we go about our day, the way we go about it, our mood doesn't affect us. It affects every single person we come in contact with. And the truth we can really see for ourselves. You know, we all have those friends that whenever they call, it's like, you know, the kvetching patrol. They're on the phone and you know you're going to pick up the phone and you're going to hear all the woes and all the sorrow and all the glum. How, I don't know, I'm embarrassed to admit it, but anybody in this room don't always answer that person's call? You know, it's like, I know who it is and I know I don't really have an hour to listen to all her fetching right now, right? I'm embarrassed if I'm the only person that has that experience. On the other hand, what if you have a friend who always calls with a nice story? Do you have any of these friends, right? Or something pleasant to share, or, you know, just checking in to see how you're doing, or someone who has that, you know, disposition and will call you not to drain you of energy or ask you for, what should I do? Am I daughter, my neighbor, my father, my uncle? No, someone who's just calling to say, hey, how's it going? I just was thinking of you. You pick up those calls. You know, nowadays we can't pretend that we don't have caller ID. We used to be like, oh, I don't have caller ID. I just didn't answer the call because I was busy. Everyone knows. You saw my missed call. You know I called. We can't pretend we don't call. That's why, you know, you have to really push yourself to answer. But at the end of the day, we all know you do tend to gravitate towards, or at least want to interact with people who either will make you feel good or give you something positive to, you know, think about or interact with, or at very least not drain you of what energy you have. And that's really because our moods and our disposition, and if we go about life with a happy, positive mind frame and a, you know, glasses half full mind frame versus, you know, the other alternative, it affects everybody. Your coworkers at work, it makes a difference if you come in with a pleasant demeanor or you come in, you know, like you're sucking on a lemon every day. It makes a difference. Well, obviously, I wouldn't go, not even a question, your spouse and your family and your children, when you're grumpy and you're, you know, you slept for an hour and a half and you have too many things to do, everybody suffers. So let's not pretend that our moods are our own feelings. And how could God dear ask of me to feel or act a certain way when the reality is really everything is affected by our mood, in our own life most certainly, but the water around us, the, you know, our circle of people, community, and everybody that comes in contact with us is truly and deeply affected by our own disposition and countenance. And therefore, the fact that King David brings down this quote saying, we really need to serve God with joy, because it's not a minor thing. It's not just a detail, oh, it's just my mood, it's no one's business. Your mood affects everybody else's mood around you. And if we're here to make an impact in the world, on some level, to make this world a better place, we could be saving, you know, cockroaches in the rainforest, or whales in the ocean, or whatever, not to put down any cause, but we could be doing wonderful. I deal with students all the time, and they're on these missions for these global things, but they don't talk to their roommate because she's in the room. You know, it's like, save the whales, save the rainforest, make a difference in the world, but be a match to your roommate. Like, how global could we be? A little bit local is not going to kill anyone. So I have a different perspective sometimes on these big projects, you know, oh, well, I'm going to Katrina to rebuild. Great, but on your way out, don't slam the door on your friend's foot. You know, it's like, why am I, side thing, forget that. But really, the essence of this command, if you will, that we need to serve God with joy is because it makes all the difference. Not just some of the difference, but all the difference. And if we want to make this world a better place, big, grand, global projects are important. They're vital. They're fundamental to improving the world. But don't take it more seriously than your own mood, because on a certain level, that makes even more of a difference. So there was a great Talmudic sage. His name was Rabbah. He actually was the dean of the Talmudic Academy. And it said that whenever he began a discourse in, you know, intricate halachic details and you know, the minutia of Jewish law, he would always begin with a joke. And everybody knows that, you know, okay, any public speaker or politician or whatever starts with a joke. Why? It's not like rocket science. Because if people can smile and lighten up a bit and relax and laugh, you connect on a certain level. And then people are more open and willing to hear what you have to say if, you know, you could get them to smile. But that's really simplistic if you think about the fact that Rabbah had in his academy, it was, so to speak, the Harvard of the Talmudic age. So who was sitting in his academy? Brilliant scholars. Sages in their own right, and they were there because academically they were of the highest caliber, and they were there seriously to study. It wasn't just like a little touchy-feely, you know, class, give me, you know, halachic 101. This was like a serious crew. He needed to start with a joke. So the explanation is that it's starting a joke or getting someone to laugh or to smile is so much greater than just kind of breaking the ice. Why? Because it says about joy, that simcha poritz geder, joy breaks all boundaries and barriers. And we know in our own lives we have barriers around our mind, around our heart. We have our own, you know, little fortresses of things that we protect and things that, you know, we're insecure about. And when we're in a dark place, how much thicker and stronger are those barriers? Whereas we're in a light and happy place, do we sometimes, are we able to let people in a little bit because we're feeling a little bit open? That's maybe on an emotional level, but on an intellectual level, when somebody's in a dark, gloomy place, their mind is preoccupied with that. And to be expansive and think in a creative way and be open-minded, you need to have a certain lightness of your mind. And so it says that when Rava would start his serious, you know, intellectual and Talmudic discourse on halacha or whatever it was, he would start with a joke. Why? So that his students' minds would open up in order for them to be able to better absorb, understand, process, and think creatively and more out of the box, because simcha, joy, has a way of breaking these type of boundaries. Emotionally, we understand to and relate to for sure, but also intellectually, you're able to process more. And I think, you know, we all on a certain level could relate to that. Most people heard, you know, in today's day and age, you heard people define, not necessarily me or the rabbi, but people, you know, as Hasidim, you know, Hasids, or Hasidism. And before the Hasidim were actually called Hasidim, that name was coined, they were called der Freilicher, like the happy ones, the joyful ones. And you always see pictures of like the two guys in the, you know, dancing the kazatska or something, the two, my mother actually painted that first, you know, two guys dancing with the black, that, you know, black hats and coats that everybody, you know, you see on some form or the other. They were called their freilicher, like the joyous ones, the happy ones, because Hasidim were famous for always being, you know, upbeat, always a reason to laugh, to sing, to rejoice, to celebrate. And there was a man who was really quite bothered by this. So he went to the Baal Shem Tov, who was the founder of the Hasidic movement. He said, you know what, I know you guys are called the freilicher, like, you know, the joyous ones, the happy ones. And people maybe think that's a big virtue that you always could break out into song on any, you know, occasion. Very, I think you guys belong in an insane asylum. Like, I'm sorry, I don't get it. What is there so much to be happy about? Like, what are you guys celebrating, really? We live in the dark ages, you guys dress the part, and here you are, and you know, you're always ready to break into a song. You're loony, like, explain this to me. I don't get it. So the Baal Shem Tov said, let me tell you a story. He said there was a fellow, extremely talented and gifted musician, undiscovered just yet, but he was unbelievably talented, and he was in a little town on a street corner playing, you know, his violin. And one person stopped to hear this beautiful music. Another person comes along and stops to hear. Slowly but surely, people from around the town are drawn to this unbelievable melody that this talented musician's playing. And as he continues playing, the song is getting more joyful, and you can hear the happiness in this melody that this, you know, he's able to convey. And one guy starts, you know, it's a little contagious. You can't help yourself. You know, you hear loud music, and sometimes you just watch, but sometimes you just, it grabs you, and you need to participate. You need to act. You need to dance. So one person dances, another one. Sure enough, the entire town's, you know, all the members of the town that had come together to hear this, you know, beautiful music started dancing around. And they're really enjoying this. They're all swept up in the moment. And one unfortunate fellow was deaf. He comes out of his shop and he looks on the street corner and he sees circles of people dancing around. He thinks, what the heck is going on? It's an average Tuesday. Are these people nuts? Have they lost their mind? And of course he goes over and somebody tells him, no, beautiful music is played and everybody's, you know, that's why we're all dancing. So the Baal Shem Tov explained to this man, he said, why did this deaf man not appreciate what everyone else, why everyone was dancing? He simply didn't hear the music. Not his own fault. Had he heard the music, he would not have had any question why everybody was dancing. So what he explained, obviously, about the Hasidim being happy, he says, on some level, every human being is able to tap into the fundamental essence of life, which all has a godly soul and a godly essence, and by very definition, there's something joyful about knowing your root, your cause, and your source. And he went on to explain that if we really understood that we're here for a reason, and everything that happens, happens for a reason, and God orchestrates our life, whether we see all the details, more often we do not, but if we were really sure in our belief that, you know what, these things happen because God wanted them that way, that would give us all the more reason to celebrate and enjoy life, because we know ultimately it's up to God. I need to do my best, I need to do my part, I need to work, but all the results, everything that happens is really in God's hands, and I could celebrate in that joy. Now, you know, on our level, that's like, okay, yeah, well, but, and we can go on from there. But if any of you interact with children, whether your own or others, you know that there's something very fascinating. A little, you know, a baby or even, you know, a little toddler, they run around the whole day happy. If they're crying, it's because something's wrong. They fell, or they need to be changed, or they need to be fed. Something's wrong. But otherwise, they're smiling, and they're laughing, and they're cooing, and they're giggling all day long. And you really don't ask yourself, huh, what's the kid laughing about, you know? We do that with us. You see someone, if you just walk down the street and you see someone grinning, you say, what are you smiling about, right? Because it's kind of like a given that we have so much not to smile about that, hey, what's up, why are you smiling about? With children, we take it for granted. Kids should be happy, and people always comment. I laugh because the students comment when my kids like, oh, they have such an easy life, and I'm like, and you? You know, like, so you go to school, you know, everything's paid for, everything's taken, you have to go and study a little bit, like, how rough. But we all kind of look at other people that way. They're like, it's so nice, the kids, they're just smiling all the time, they have no worries, they have no problems, nothing's on their shoulders. It should be that way. You know, it's a problem when you see a two-year-old that looks like they have the world on their shoulders, because generally speaking, the only mission is to destroy the house and everyone, you know, that's it, but it's a happy job. You know, let's see what we can tear down, how quickly and how efficiently, but they do it with joy, utter joy. And if we really tap into, why do children and why do young, you know, obviously infants, but young children have that joy of life, that enthusiasm, they're just excited because it's Monday. Someone actually explained to me, because I was telling Rabbi Friedman, I said, you know, my kids, no matter what time they go to sleep, they still wake up. Like, most people say, oh, if my kids go to bed late, they'll wake up later, they'll sleep in. I'm like, I don't have kids like that. They can go to bed at 11, they'll still wake up at 6. So to me, it's not worth it. There's never a reason why they should stay up late, because I'm not going to get 30 seconds later to wake up in the morning. So put them in on... So he said to me, and I was just fetching, you know, like, they, whatever I do, they wake up at the same time. He told me something very profound. He said, the day your kid wants to sleep in, that's the day they're not a kid anymore. And I'm like, whoa, what do you mean? He said, a kid, the second they're going to open their eye, they jump out of bed because it's another day. They're so excited, they're so happy, they're so enthusiastic about what's going to happen and what they're going to accomplish or what they're going to encounter over the course of the day, that the second they open their eyes, before the second eye opens, one foot's on the floor and you start hearing, mommy, breakfast, you know. What happens eventually, and it's not, it doesn't take that long, you know, my 9-year-old's already getting there, I don't want to get up yet, why? Somehow or the other, they're starting to understand, today is going to be very similar to yesterday. You know, they're starting to understand that it's not that exciting if it's just a random day and they're not going or doing something special. And that's kind of, I don't mean to be really gloomy, but the beginning of the end. Meaning, when they're a child, they every single moment, they're really, really enthusiastic. Once they're like, yeah, wake me up in an hour, or they want to roll over, you get that's when they start being tainted by the adult world, or our world, because they start realizing, huh, you know, maybe it's, there's not great reason to be excited. So really, I once he explained that to me, I was like, you know what, I'm going to be happy when my kids wake up, you know, bright first thing in the morning, because it really means that they're enthusiastic to get up. And I wish I felt that way instead of like, let's, how many times should we do the snooze on the alarm clock, which we all experience. But we really can understand that children have that natural curiosity and joy and enthusiasm in life. Why? Because they're so intimately in touch with their soul and with godliness and spirituality. We have to work hard to maintain that or to reintroduce that or to connect with that, you know, neshama, that soul, because life does many things to us. And part of that process, we lose a little bit of that connection and that enthusiasm with the essence, with the source, which is joyful and happy. And I think I was quite surprised, as we used to do at Emory, we used to do Shabbat services on campus with all the different denominations would do services together. And one week we invited president of the university, who was William Chase, I don't know if anybody knows him, but he was invited to come celebrate Shabbat with the Jewish community at Emory. And the way we would do it is Chabad and Hillel, we would have Everybody would get together for like a Oneg Shabbat, and then we would divide up into three different services: Reform, Conservative, and I don't know, Chabad, you know. And labels, I'm not into labels, they just mean nothing to me, so it was, you know. And then everyone would get back together after services, and we'd all have dinner together either at the Chabad house or the Hillel house or on campus. So President Chase was invited to join us, and so he had the, you know, distinct pleasure of having to go in, you know, a half hour. Friday night services are not very long, to attend all the three different services, and he did that. And at the meal, he stood up to, you know, share a few words. And I'm only telling this story because this is what President Chase shared with us. And he's a Methodist, very, you know, I don't know if he's a minister himself, but Emory is a Methodist school, although they say Emory stands for Early Methodist, Only Recently Yiddish. Quite, you know, 40% Jewish population. I think we outnumber the Methodists, but he's a good, true, strong, believing, and practicing Methodist. And he, you know, we invited him to share a few words with the students, and this is what he said. He said, you know, you learn something from everybody all the time. And he said, I always had this conception about religion that I find obviously in my own religion, but I just assumed I would find in Judaism. And this is what my perception was, that the more religious somebody is, the more serious and devout and hardcore they are. It's like in my religion, that's how it is. It's like, so I was assuming that when I came to join the Jewish community, I would find the same thing within Judaism. He says, well, tonight I was, you know, privileged and honored. I had distinct, you know, pleasure of attending three different services. And he said, you know, I walked into the Reform service. It was lovely. There were people reading back and forth and answering. And it was really inspiring. It was beautiful. It's like I walked in the Conservative service and there were people, you know, they were humming a tune all together and it was so nice. It's like when I finished that, I walked into the, you know, Orthodox service. And he's like, I was just shocked because I'm thinking, you know, the more religious I'm getting, the more serious I'm going to find the service to be. And the more, you know, hardcore, the more devout the members will be. Because if you're Orthodox, you're that much more, you know, I don't know which word he used. I don't know if it was so complimentary. But like, you're that much more devout and into it. So then I come to the Orthodox service and he's like, it was like a party, singing and dancing and everyone's going in a circle. And he's like, I was just so surprised to find that it seems like in Judaism, the more religious you get, the more happy and enthusiastic you seem to be. When in my religion, I find that, you know, the more religious you are, the more serious and, you know, you don't take things lightly. So what he, in essence, was telling everyone was he found that within Judaism, the more someone celebrated or the more someone appreciated, the more happy and joyous they seemed to be. And that's what his personal, you know, interpretation of going to these different services, that's what he found. Now, I can tell you he did not make many friends that night because the students who were in the other group were like, we're happy, you know, like, excuse me. You know, he just walked in when we were saying Kaddish. You know, that's not our fault. But at the end of the day, this was what he shared. And he said, that was his Devar Torah, if you will, that it's so beautiful to see that within Judaism, the more into it you are, translates into a more joyous and enthusiastic. He didn't know that, you know, my husband's a Chabad rabbi, and that's part of the davening, is everyone dances around, ay, 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 in the circle, and not necessarily were those students so religious or devout. Anyway, it's just, at Emory, it's not an Orthodox population by any stretch. I think there's, you know, three students who I could say, you know, maybe consider themselves on some level, you know, I don't know, practicing. It's just not the right location if you're looking to find, you know, a blooming Orthodox community, but that's not the point either. But that was what he found, and there is some truth to that, because the more you're in tune with God's mission for us and the understanding and appreciation that God has a reason for us to be here and everything that happens to us happens for a reason, the more you sometimes are able to just let things go, because you know what? It's in God's hands, so I'm going to do my part and I'm going to smile, and the stuff that goes on is God's issue. But that's obviously a little bit you know, oversimplifying the issue. Is there was a guy who walks into a bar one evening, he orders himself, you know, a gin and tonic, he sits down, he's, you know, finishes drinking, and he picks up his glass and he throws it at the bartender's head. Now this bartender was quick, he ducks, and the glass shatters behind him into, you know, thousands of pieces. And he looks at the guy and he says, are you crazy? You almost killed me. What's wrong with you? And the man stands up and he says, I'm so sorry, I apologize, you know, I'm so embarrassed, I'm humiliated, I have this uncontrollable rage, and just sometimes when I think about things, I get so angry and I can't control myself, and I, please forgive me. And the guy's like, you know, I forgive you, like, go home, you know, have a good night, you know, thank you. A couple nights later, the same guy comes into the bar, he sits down and he orders a, you know, whatever, vodka on the rocks, drinks his drink, and the bartender's kind of watching him a little wearily out of the corner of his eye. Sure enough, he finishes his drink, and he wings the glass at the bartender's head again, misses by an inch, glass shatters, and the bartender says, you're nuts. The man goes into his whole explanation again about his uncontrollable rage, and he's so sorry, and he's embarrassed, and he apologizes, and he says, you know what, your apologies and your embarrassment are beautiful, but until you go to some serious therapy, please do not come back to my bar. Like, this is not cool. Sure enough, the guy doesn't appear for 6 months, and one fine evening, he strolls back in, and he lets the bartender know that he did indeed go to therapy before he orders his drink. Intensive therapy for 6 months. So the bartender gives him whatever it was that he ordered, and he drinks and he finishes his drink, and without any ceremony, he picks up his glass and he wings it at the bartender's head, and the bartender says, what's wrong with you? I thought we had this discussion, and we... And he says, yes, I did. I went to therapy, and you know what? I'm not embarrassed anymore. I'm not ashamed anymore. So, I don't know if this really happened, but I think it illustrates something. In our culture, we place, you know, I could say this only because I interact with a lot of psych, you know, majors and people that are studying, you know, psychology and whatever. We place a very strong emphasis in our culture about getting comfortable with yourself, being comfortable with who you are, and, you know, really just you know, developing yourself and just coming to terms with your personality and your disposition, and not necessarily to the degree of, you know, working to change, but working to accept and appreciate who you are, and that's a very big emphasis, and to some degree it is important, but to some degree all our mishigasin and all our depression and all our moods and all our grumpiness is not necessarily always something that is in everybody's best interest for us to come to terms with and accept and embrace and appreciate. Judaism puts a much stronger emphasis in looking to correct and change and improve those negativities in ourselves, rather than saying, you know what, this is me, this is who I am, and if you don't like it, go join a different sorority, you know, because this is who I am. We want to say that about ourselves, about the positive things. The negative things, we want to say, maybe this is who I am, I'm predisposed to these things, but I'm working really hard to change them or to improve them or to upgrade them, and not to just get comfortable with them. So, you know, really, I would say the biggest obstacle to happiness is human nature. Because we all want to be happy. Everybody strives for happiness. Everybody's looking for happiness. Everyone thinks happiness will be found somewhere else. And the biggest obstacle that comes in our way is our own nature. But it's not a bad thing, because this is how God created us. How did God create us? We're really insatiable. Whatever we have, we always want more. Whatever we have, it's not enough of. And I know if any of you are familiar with the talk show host, he's an author as well, Dennis Prager. He coined this syndrome, the missing tile syndrome. It says, like, human nature is you walk into a beautiful ballroom where everything's, like, absolutely, unbelievably decorated and decked out, and you see one tile that's, you know, missing in the ceiling, and any, you know, person worth their salt will say, what? That tile's missing. Like, what kind of... horrible, you know, place is this? They, you know, they couldn't fix the tile. We do that with everybody. You know, you see someone perfectly dressed, but there's a little stain on their tie. It's like, what kind of schnook is this? You know, well, who brought this schlepper in? You know, you see, so everything's perfectly dressed, and there's a run in the stockings, or there's, you know, we notice right away that one thing that's missing or one thing that's not there. I had a student call me the other day, and she's like, she went out on a date with a guy, and it was so wonderful. What a great guy, but she just, it's not for her. I said, why not? Because she's like, all night long, this guy had a piece of spinach in his teeth. And she couldn't think anything he said and anything he was talking about. She was so distracted by the fact that he had spinach in his teeth or in his tooth that she couldn't focus. She's like, all she kept thinking was, this guy has spinach in his teeth. And he's going on and he's talking, and she was just, and I'm thinking, like, you know, maybe give this guy a second chance here, you know? Why? She wasn't focusing on the fact that he's an accomplished, pleasant, you know, lovely fellow who was really had a lot to say for himself, is very... No, he had spinach in his teeth, and that was just something she was trying to get over, and she knew it was ridiculous, but she was just really distracted. So I told her this story, which isn't really a story, because it happens to all of us on different levels. I thank God I'm blessed, I have 8 brothers, And one of my brothers was dating, and he's quite an intellectual fellow, and he was kind of on a mission to find out, like, what's the most important thing when you're looking for a spouse? Like, what are you really looking for? Like, what's the most important quality? So you go out, you know, on a date, and he'd come back, and he'd talk to him, like, how'd it go? And he would say, you know, I realize the most important quality in a woman is intellect. Like, she needs to be smart. If she's not smart, then there's no discussion. You're not listening to anything she has to say, because she doesn't have anything to say, because there's nothing doing up there. It's just really important. I'm like, okay, that's fine. That's, you know. A few weeks later, he'd call me back, and he'd say, you know, I went out with this other person, and I really realized the most important thing, you know, when looking for a spouse, is they need to have a sense of humor, because if they're not funny and they're just intellectual and they're smart but they're so serious and they take them so seriously, who wants to spend their life with like a rocket scientist that can't smile? Like, it's just really important. I'm like, okay, fine. A few weeks later, a month later, a month or two, he calls me back again. You know, I really figured out what the most important thing is. Like, what is that? She needs to be good looking. She needs to be pretty. Like, if she's really smart and she's really funny, but she looks like, you know, a toad, it doesn't help you anything. You. She needs to be pleasant to look at. I'm like, this went on and on for 2 years, okay? Every time he'd call me up, I went out with this one, that one, and I finally figured out what the most important thing is, and he'd tell me something. Anyway, one time he calls me up and he's like, I finally, really, really just figured out what the most important thing is. And I'm like, listen, I know what you're going to tell me. He's like, you don't even know who I went out with. I'm like, it's not important. He's like, what do you mean? Of course it's important. Let me tell you who I went out with, and I'm going to tell you, you know, what the most, I said, no. Anything that this girl was missing, whatever she did not have, whatever that particular date seemed to be glaringly lacking, that is going to be suddenly the most important feature or, you know, quality that you're looking for. And there's like complete silence at the other end of the line. He's like,
you're right.
No great insight on my part. This is human nature, that we always are looking, unfortunately or fortunately, for what's missing or what's not there. Now, when I say fortunately, it's because most of our advances that we appreciate today and experience in technology and all the things are only there because we weren't satisfied with a car that only went from 0 to 60 in 2 minutes. We wanted one that went from 0 to 60 in a minute and a half. Where are you going that fast, and why you need it, I don't know. But if you bought a computer or a camera or a phone 2 years ago, it is beyond obsolete, because human nature is faster, quicker, better, you know, smoother, and that's a wonderful thing, especially in medical technology and in many things in our world. Because human nature is insatiable, because we always see what's missing and what could be improved and what could be better, we have that luxury, if you will, of all the wonderful technology and things we come in contact with. In human relations, it could be a little bit of a problem, because if everyone can always improve and be better and I'm never happy with how things are or who people are, then we can get into a little bit of a stickier situation if we apply that same missing tile syndrome, seeing what's missing instead of what's there. It can be quite a problem. And that's why it really comes from, you know, getting back to that first quote that I quoted from Psalms. It says, "Ivdu et Hashem b'simcha." We need to work on being happy, because naturally we would look at what's missing and what's not there. And it takes work and effort and energy to see what is there and what is positive and what we could appreciate. And I could tell you the ending of the story. The very next girl my brother went out with, he's been married to for 10 years with 3 lovely children. I don't know if that had anything to do with it. It could just be he found the right person, or it could just be he wasn't looking for what she didn't have. He appreciated what she did have. I don't know. I'm not God. I can't say. But it's an interesting fact. The good thing, I think, in our society is we're all members, knowingly or unknowingly, of a cult. You're all looking at me like, hello. What do I mean, we're members of a cult? We're all members of a cult, because being members of a cult means you're obsessed. It's not necessarily rational. You'll spend money even though it's a complete waste of money, etc., etc. And what's the name of this cult? Hollywood. Somehow or the other, we're all obsessed with who and what and where and when. Every newsstand, every, you know, Kroger, shopping mall, you need to find out who's doing what. And it's really a gift to all of us. Why? Because we assume, what do we need to be happy? A little more money, a little bit of a better job, a straighter nose, 10 inches less on the waistline, you know, a nicer, you know, spouse or neighbor, a prettier house, a better job. Everyone has their little list of, like, if only I had this, that, or the other, I would be happier. And it could be as, you know, as simple as, you know, if I had a better car, I wouldn't be so aggravated. You know? And the list grows and grows. And what do we have? We have this you know, phenomenon, so to speak, of called Hollywood, if you will, where the people there seem to have it all. The power, fame, money, the, you know, best-looking people with the best parties, with the best dresses, with the best... And the beauty of it is that we're really able to see and learn that not necessarily do these things lead to, cause, or create happiness on any level. And thank God everybody in our society is so open and willing to share, you know, all the details of their intimate life that we're able to really understand that, you know what, these things, you might have it all, but depression and anger and substance abuse and all these things are not found in places where everything else that we want is found. And it gives us a very profound understanding and appreciation for the fact that the things we think will make us happy, they might for a few minutes, you know, or longer than that. But real happiness, true happiness, isn't going to come from the things and the stuff. And the people who have the things and the stuff are not necessarily the happiest people we know. People say, well, who's the happiest person you know? Usually it's no one you know very well. Because anyone you know very well, you know all their issues and all their details. But if you have to think, you know, who's the person that's really happy? It's not always the person that has it all. Most often we find that it's not. It's the person who has so many struggles and challenges and was given so many trying circumstances and situations, and we admire and respect them because despite all that, they managed to find some level of happiness and contentment with their lot. So there's a famous discussion in the Gemara where it talks about the fact that a human being should praise God and thank God equally for when something good happens to them, just as when something bad happens. And the Baal Shem Tov, again, the founder of the Hasidic movement, had two of his disciples who were studying this piece, and they were really bothered by it. To them, it made no sense. How in the world do you expect somebody to appreciate and thank and bless God when something bad happens to them, just as if something good happens? It goes against human nature. If something good happens, you say thank you and you're appreciative. Something bad happens, I should also say thank you, God. You know, my car crashed or my this broke or my... No one... It doesn't make sense. So they asked the Baal Shem Tov, they said, we don't understand this at all. Can you explain this to us? He says, I'm sorry, I can't. You're going to have to go to Reb Zusha. He'll explain it to you. Where's Reb Zusha? He lives in a town called Anipoli, you know, a couple towns over. So they said, you know what? They were really on a mission to find out what the secret or the answer to this teaching was. And they went and they traveled to Anipoli. They get to the town and they're asking everybody, do you know where Reb Zusha lives? And everyone directs them to the very farthest edge of the town, a little hut, a hovel. This is where Reb Zusha lives. Come to the door and they see that this hut is like in disrepair beyond belief. There's cracks, there's holes, there's wind coming through. It's a, you know, it's a Russian winter. And this is where Reb Zusha lives. Utter poverty. They knock on the door and Reb Zusha opens the door. Inside, the place is as bare and sorry looking as it is on the outside. Reb Zusha welcomes them, invites them in with a huge smile. Welcome, what can I do? My visitors, my guests. They said, well, we were sent by the Baal Shem Tov, and he's ecstatic. The Baal Shem Tov sent you. He's so thrilled. What did the Baal Shem Tov send you for? He invites them in. Come, sit down. He pulls up whatever it is, you know, a log, whatever it was he had to sit on. Make yourselves at home. Sit down. And this guy is just exuberantly happy to have these two visitors. And they said, well, we were studying with the, you know, holy Baal Shem Tov, and our master told us that you would have the answer to our question. Me, humble Zusha, I don't know. What's your question? So they said, well, we were studying this particular, you know, Talmudic, you know, piece where it talks about a person appreciating God in good times and in bad and thanking God for the trials as well as the joys. And we're not getting it. So Zusha's very quiet and he's stroking his beard, maybe, I don't know. And he's thinking and he's thinking. He looks up at them and he says, you know what? I don't understand why the Baal Shem Tov sent you to me. I can't help you. They said, no. The Baal Shem Tov said we should go to Zusha of Anipoli. We know you're the only Zusha in Anipoli. And you're going to have the answer. You can't leave us like this. You need to tell us something. He says, well, I'm sorry. I'm really unable to help you because in my whole life, God never gave me anything that I would feel despair or upset. No, I've never had any challenges. I can't relate. I don't understand. So they look at each other. And they look around the room, and they look at where this guy's living and what he has, and they shake their heads and they say, thank you very much. And I'm sure they had a long discussion on the way home. Why did the Baal Shem Tov send us to Reb Zusha? who has looks like he has absolutely nothing, but he can't understand because God never gave him anything bad. He never had any trial. He never had anything that he viewed as a challenge. And obviously, Rav Zusha was a sage and a scholar and a mystic in his own right, and not, you know, necessarily something that we could all identify with on a very cozy level in terms of relating. But they learned a lesson from this Rav Zusha that the things that we view as negative in life is really very often our perception. It's very often we think it's negative, but somebody else in that same situation may not. And if we have a deeper understanding of the world we live in, we may have a different appreciation. To me, when I heard that story, I was like, you know, it's a beautiful thing, but on a practical level in 2010, how many people could relate to a guy who lives in poverty that doesn't think that there's any challenge to it? So I had the distinct privilege of taking my kids for immunization. You know, they have to get their shots this time of year. And I had a different, you know, insight into the same concept, but on a more maybe modern level, if you will. So I figured I would share it. What happens? I told the doctor, you know, I'm bringing 3 kids in to, you know, get their shots. So I'm going to come in with my husband so we could be in different rooms, because if one kid sees the other kid get the shots, they're going to be nervous in advance. You know, it's not going to go as smoothly. So I'm like, there we are. I'm sitting there, and my 4-year-old, who really likes doctors, he's very curious. He thinks this is, like, really cool. He has his own doctor said. He never had an unpleasant doctor experience. The doctor comes in to give, you know, the first shot, and he was smiling until he got the first shot, and then he was like really angry, like, how could you do this to me? And the second shot had to be given, and so I'm holding him down so the doctor could give him the shot in his leg, and as I'm holding him, he's hugging me like, mommy, and I'm like, it's okay, and I'm holding his arm so the doctor could give him a shot, and I'm thinking, this is bizarre. If anybody would walk into this room and not know what immunization is or shots are, they would think, what kind of cruel, evil, wicked mother am I? I'm holding my kid down while my kid's hugging me for comfort, telling my kid, like, it's okay, holding the leg so the doctor can give the shot. Like, this is, like, horrific. But no one would really think that, because everyone knows that immunization is for the kid's best interest so they don't get other things that are worse. And as a loving, caring mother, I'm comforting my child at the same time because I know it's for his own good. It'll be okay in the end, not in a very long time. And I'm holding him down because this is what needs to happen. And I figured, you know what? It's really an example of, like, we all get in life, although we don't view it this way, of, like, a divine immunization, meaning very often things happen in our lives that are painful, that are uncomfortable, that are unwarranted, unasked for, unexpected, etc. And at the very same time that these, you know, something negative or something, you know, very unhappy, if you will, happens to us, it doesn't mean that God cares about us, loves us, or is holding us any tighter than when something good happens. Now, again, it's still something that we have to work to grasp, because we're human beings, and we say, you know what, if you really loved us so much, so do nice things for us. And if you really cared, so, you know, let us feel it, not have to really understand, well, through the pain or through the darkness or, you know, through these bad things, really something good. The example people always use is like a tapestry. It's beautiful on the front, and it, you know, it depicts usually a beautiful picture or a scenery, but if you look behind, you see all the knots and the snarled, you know, threads that are used to create it. And we, unfortunately, usually see, you know, the side that has all the knots and the confusion and the chaos and the what's going on here, rather than the other side of that very same cloth. But ultimately, this idea of working, ivdu et Hashem b'simcha, the word ivdu, if any of you have had the pleasure of studying Hebrew or know anything about the Hebrew language, it has a very deep richness to every single word and letter. And the word ivdu, which means to serve God, comes from the very same word as the word avodah, which means work. That it's not easy. We may understand and we may know that everything God does has a purpose and that our lives aren't just meaningless and that we need to actually work to incorporate and translate those ideas into real feelings that we could appreciate. The very end of the same slogan, ivdu, comes from the word avoda, that it means work. It's not easy. Happiness, although for a child it may come easy, for an adult, because so many more things we perceive and we understand, it's that much more difficult for us to get over. The end of the word, it says, ivdu es Hashem to simcha. The word simcha in Hebrew means happiness, joy, happiness. But simcha also comes from the same numerical value or the same evaluation as the word machshava, which means intellect. Why? Because joy, maybe for a child, it's just innate and it's just something that they, you know, exude at all times. But for an adult, it's something that we have to actually work on, ivdu, we have to work on in our intellect. We have to understand and appreciate that sometimes I just need to let go, and sometimes I may be in a bad mood, but I'm just going to put my smile on my face anyway to my kids, to my husband, to my coworkers, because I know and I understand that that's going to make the world a better place. It might not come easy, it might not be something that I would naturally do, but I understand it's work, and I understand it's something I actually have to do. So I want to leave off, because in Judaism, when you hear, you know, interesting ideas or stories about a certain topic, it never does any good unless you have something practical that you can do about it. Meaning, I heard something interesting or I understood a concept, but if I don't have something practical to do, where does it really take me? In Judaism, we really bless that every single concept and idea we have manifest in an actual mitzvah or something we can do. And this concept of happiness, of appreciating that which we have, comes from, it actually in Ethics of Our Fathers, it says, Ezehu Ashir, who is wealthy, Hasameach Bechalko, those who are happy with what they have. So it's not necessarily what you have, but it's appreciating whatever it is. And it's not necessarily, I'm going to be happy when I get this, or when I get that promotion, or when I get married, or when I have kids, or when my kids leave the house, or when I retire. It's not the destination that's going to cause happiness, but it's understanding that if I'm happy right now, right here, with everything I have on my plate at this time, the good, the bad, and the ugly, if I appreciate what I have, then I'm truly a happy person. And that's an effort to appreciate what we have, but it's something that we can wrap our mind around. Look, if I can work on that, appreciating what I have, it'll cause me to be a happier person, which will affect myself and everybody I come in contact with. And Judaism gives us many ways on a really deep level to express that appreciation constantly. I'll just throw out two, because there's so many. But two things that we, you know, might help to incorporate. One thing is very fascinating. We have a blessing that we say every time we come out of the bathroom. And most times when people hear this, they're like, you're kidding me. Like, you've got to be kidding. Everyone knows you make a blessing, bore pri hagafen, or, you know, hamotzi lechem, and, you know, bread and wine, we thank God, we praise for this festive occasion, like, very nice. But we also have a prayer that we say every time we go to the bathroom, which seems like quite bizarre. Because no one wants to think twice about any of the details that go into the fact that our body functions, gives us energy and nutrients, and the things we need are there for our body to use, the things we don't need, you know, are eliminated and all that. But if we were to take a moment to just appreciate the simplicity and the, I would say the simplicity, but the amazement that our own bodies really have just to teach us in the way they function, and God created every one of us that works in a way that we're able to function and be healthy, we take it more than just for granted. Judaism says, you know what, don't just take it for granted. When you come out of the bathroom, you thank God that everything worked right. Everything, you know, did what it needed to do, and you're healthy for it. We never want to think that, because it's like, you know, who thinks about that? Judaism says, no. When you come out of the bathroom, you say a prayer also, thank you God that everything worked. Why? Because if I appreciated the very details of the fact that I breathe and I eat and I sleep and I get up and I'm happy because everything's functioning, we would be people that are that much more appreciative of everything we have in life. The things that we for sure take it, you know, for granted, and the things we shouldn't take for granted. Another thing, which, you know, on a more profound level, we have a prayer. It's a 12-word prayer, if I remember it all correctly, that we're supposed to say every morning. We're supposed to say, Moda ani lefanecha, I thank God for returning my soul back to me and giving me a new day. So I start out every day with appreciation. God didn't do anything. I didn't even open my eyes. It could be the worst day of my life ahead of me. Everything could go wrong today, but how do I start it out? I start out by saying, you know what, God, thank you for giving me back my soul, for giving me a new slate, a new page, a new leaf. I can make a difference today. I could be better today than I was yesterday. And we start out by saying, appreciating and expressing that appreciation. How much different would our days be if we really took those 12 words and for 1 minute, 60 seconds out of the day, you know, meditated or contemplated about this idea? Thank you, God gave me another day. Let me see if I could make it, you know, that much better than yesterday was. Or let me see if I could make this day, you know, a day that when I go to sleep at night, I could say, you know what, God? It's good you gave me that day because I did this. I made that person smile. I called that person. I went out of my way. Whatever it is we do in our day. So there's many, many ways in Judaism that we're given to really internalize this concept of appreciating every single detail. Those that we take for granted, and the things that we shouldn't even take for granted. I just want to conclude with a story. It's a story that my kids really like, so I say it a lot, but it's applicable to the topic of happiness. There were two Hasidic masters who were brothers. One of them we mentioned before, his name was Reb Zusha, who lived in Anipoli, a simple man, of great, simple materially, but great spiritually. And he had a brother whose name was Elimelech. And what they used to do is they used to travel around together to all the nearby villages and towns. And when they got to a town, they would inspire the local townspeople that even though they seemed to be a simple water carrier or a cobblesmith or whatever it was that they did, that God really loves and appreciates and cherishes every single Jew, every single human being, and every single person in their own service of God, even if it seems very simple. And they would inspire, you know, all the locals in their service of their Creator. And they would travel around from city to city, talking to people and uplifting them. And one evening, they were walking from between two towns, and they were engrossed in some deep Hasidic, you know, idea or concept, and they didn't realize that they were walking across the beautifully manicured front lawn of the Paritz, the landowner. And he's sitting in his house, and he sees these two bearded, hairy Hasidic Jews marching across his property as if, you know, they own the place, and he was outraged. So I'm going to teach these two Jews a lesson. I'm going to throw them in the prison, you know, for the evening for trespassing across my property. That's exactly what he did. Throws them into the local prison, and they're sharing one cell with all the local friendly folks. You know, the pickpocket and the, you know, all the local, you know, riffraff is in there with them. And they're like, you know, we're going to mind our own business here and go into the corner and go schlaf. You know, we're going to go to sleep. So that's what they do. They go to sleep, and they wake up early in the morning, and Elimelech starts crying. His brother, Zusha, says to him, why are you crying? Why are you so upset? Like, it's not such a big deal. He says, no, you don't understand. He says, every single day of my life, I woke up and I began my day by praying, by thanking my Creator, by connecting to my Creator, by davening, serving God. And today, I'm not able to do so because look over there. So Zusha looks, and what does he see? A chamber pot. This was no, you know, local Motel 6. This was, you know, the old Russian prison, and the facilities weren't up to snuff. They had one chamber pot, and that was the local bathroom, and everybody would do their thing, and it just sat there. And it was disgusting, and it smelled, and it was repulsive. And Elimelech says the Jewish law states that if you're in a place with something disgusting, you're not allowed to pray. It's not appropriate. It's not respectful to talk to God with something, you know, in your immediate surrounding that's unpleasant. And look, we can't leave, and this thing's sitting here, and it's not going anywhere, and I can't daven. So Zusha says, my brother, listen to me. The same God that you wake up every morning and you connect to and you pray with, that's the same God who tells you you should daven every morning. He also says when you're in a place where something is gross or disgusting, you shouldn't daven. You're still doing what he wants. Either way, you're serving God. You're listening to God. You're doing what God wants. Normally, it's by praying and connecting. And today, it happens to be through not davening because there's something in the room that's gross. You're still doing exactly what God wants. So Elimelech breaks out in a huge smile. He says, you're right. He's so excited that his brother just taught him a new, you know, lesson in divine service and a deeper appreciation that he is serving God just in a different way. He was so excited. He did what all the traditional Hasidic, you know, masters would do. He broke out in a little kazatska. So they start dancing. Oh, and they start doing, you know, the fiddler on the roof dance. And they're dancing. Everybody knows dancing's contagious, so one guy gets up and starts joining them, and another guy, and everyone's like, ho, 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 and they're all going around in circles around this chamber pot, dancing and singing, and sure enough, this commotion wakes up the guard, who's, you know, having a little snooze at the front door, and he bangs open the door, and he says, what's going on here? This is a prison. What are you guys all so excited about? What are you celebrating? So everybody stops. It's the Jews. We don't know. They're crazy. She says, what do you mean it's the Jews? What are you celebrating? So the inmates say, well, we don't know. They're nuts. There's something about the chamber pot is making them really happy. We don't know. They're crazy, but they're happy because something with the chamber pot, we don't know. So the guard says, you're excited because of the chamber pot? You guys are nuts. I'm taking this out of here. So he picks up the chamber pot. He marches out of the room, slams the door behind himself. And Zusha turns to Elimelech and he says, now, my brother, you can daven. So why do I share this story in closing with you? Because in life, unfortunately, we do sometimes encounter chamber pots. And not always do we have the internal or external support or peace of mind to appreciate that there's a joy, there's a lesson, there's something that we can gain, and there's a perspective that we may have that would cause us to view that negative scenario or situation in a different light. Not always, I don't mean on a superficial level that anytime anything negative happens, we just, you know, smile and do a little kizatzka, because I don't know anyone who would appreciate that, but to really on an internal level say, you know what, the challenges that I'm given usually make me stronger. The challenges that I have, although today I don't see it and I can't appreciate why and what I need this for, very often we're given that hindsight view of being able to see, you know what, I came through that stronger, and the fact that I went through that made me a better person. You have many people in life who are usually the happiest people who could tell you, yes, I went through many troubles and trials and tribulations, but we end up, if we view it in the proper perspective, being more content and having more, you know, better peace of mind, if you will, and going about our lives in a way where we're able to not only appreciate in our own, you know, small little worlds what's going on in our own lives, but being able to exude that happiness and that peace and then tranquility and that smile to the people around us, which really will make this world a happier, more peaceful and pleasant place for all of us. So I just, in the month of Adar, I want to wish everyone a l'chaim, that we should tap into the energy that's inherent in the month, because sometimes we don't have it within ourselves. You know, we're supposed to be happy, we're supposed to be joyous, but you know what? Stuff that's going on in my life is a chamber pot, and I'm not smiling. And the month of Adar comes to tell us that in this month, every Jewish month has an energy in it. And the month of Adar, that energy is happiness, which means I might not find it in myself right this moment, but the month itself has that energy, and if I could just tap into it out there in the air around me, I can internalize and pull some of that joy and energy from the outside and pull it in, versus where other months were expected to pull it out and, you know, let it go outwards. And other, it's that gift that God says, you know what, the month itself will exude joy and you can internalize it and take it in. And that's why Rabbi Ari started by saying, Mishanichnas Adar, when Adar comes in, joy is increased because it's in the air. What we need to do is we need to tap into that and pull it in so that we could shoot it out as well. So I wish everyone a l'chaim. If you have wine on the table, if you didn't drink it already, l'chaim, that we should all be able to appreciate and enjoy that happiness and express it to those around us who need it, and through that joy be uplifted, and hopefully we'll be all be celebrating Purim in Jerusalem together in the most happy and joyous way. So l'chaim, and a happy month of Adar for everybody.
L'chaim.
Do some Q&A.
I don't know if there's anybody any questions.
My I personally have a question, which is, when are you coming back?
Yeah.
But if anybody has a question or wants to
question,
raise an
comment,
issue,
comment, alternate speech or viewpoint, whatever.
Rebuttal.
Yeah. Yes.
Have you read the books "Happiness Is a Serious Problem" by Dennis Prager, "Happier" by Ben Tal Shahar?
Yes, I'm into this topic.
Pliskin also. Why would you compare and contrast what they have to say in your message tonight?
I think a little bit of nothing I said I've created on my own. I'm not a creative, you know, independent thinker. I kind of take all the things that work for me and put them back out there. So I would say, honestly, different things from different books I internalize and then share with others because they work for me. My favorite of those three is Dennis Prager's book, "Happiness Is a Serious Problem." It's like highly recommended if you haven't, you know, ever read it. It's worth going and buying it and owning it because it's a book you could pick up whenever. But I think, I don't know unless you have something specific of like, you know, where there was a disagreement, you know. But I think they're all great books with different, you know. I think ultimately everybody takes something outside of the same story or message. You could, you know, you have 10 people all read the same book and everyone walk away with something different. And that's because we're all individuals with our own needs and our own dispositions and our own, you know, ways we view things. So I think they're all great books. I've read them all and I don't disagree or have any conflict.
How can you deal with the challenge when you can't identify that it's a divine inoculation or you don't see the tapestry, you know, the other side of the tapestry. I mean, and you know, and you don't want to recognize that it's just a test, and resort to tefillah to resolve it, to try to help resolve it. How would you approach approach.
But I think you halfway answered your question in your question, which was, what happens if you don't want to view it as a test or as a trial? Meaning, you don't want to view it as from God. What you're basically saying is, maybe it is, but I don't want to view it that way. And that's why the idea of avoda comes in, of saying, you know what, this is work to view it that way, because I could either just view it as a random problem that happened to me, and, you know, God just hates me, or this is just random and has nothing to do with anything, and it just, you know, just occurred. And I don't know that that would give you any more peace of mind, you know, as opposed to viewing it as, this is a challenge that I'm having, and let me see if I could rise to the challenge by working within myself to view it in that light, and viewing it, you know, as you said, as a tapestry, as a divine. And prayer, there's no question that prayer gives us very often that tranquility or that peace of mind to tap into what's godly and divine. When we don't, I wouldn't say we don't always see it, we more often than not don't see it. But that's the test and that's the challenge, and, you know, it's work to do it. It's not, you know, some people more naturally are able to say, oh, you know, it's another challenge. Some people, that's a very difficult thing in and of itself, and prayer is definitely a means to, you know, connect and focus into, you know, why is this happening? What could I do to turn it into something more positive? Even though, you know, on the outset, most challenges don't feel that way at all. Anyone else? Yeah.
Wonderful talk. Thanks for being here. And I guess I'm more of a comment, but curious to hear your thoughts. As I'm listening to you speak, what strikes me is one of the problems or challenges is the questions that we ask ourselves. So, like, if I ask, what do I need to do to make me happier? What do I have to be happy about? You know, even in that kind of tone. But that's a very different question than, what am I happy about in this moment? Or what am I grateful for in this moment? So, again, just kind of curious about your thoughts about how the questions we ask ourselves influence our level of happiness.
Right. Well, I think everybody, you know, if we really went around the room, everybody could share a situation where, you know, they were pulling their hair out of their head, or they were so disturbed or upset by a certain problem, and something happened, you know, with either within themselves or somewhere else, where you just realized, hey, you know, you have a paradigm shift, and all of a sudden my problem isn't so big. It's like, you know, I think one of the famous stories people say is, there's a guy on a train, and he, you know, he sees all these kids acting rambunctious, and he's all, you know, like, what's wrong? Why is the father not taking care of the kids? And then he goes over to the father to complain, like, won't you, you know, discipline your kids? And he says, yeah, I'm really sorry, I'm a little out of it, we're just coming from their mother's funeral. And all of a sudden the guy wasn't disturbed and upset by the kids. He all of a sudden had a sympathy and a, you know, what can I do to help? All of a sudden everything changed from being annoyed to being, feeling sorry and feeling like, you know, maybe I could lend a hand, maybe I could entertain your kids. So very often, you know, you have it with any relationship in life, because usually a lot of our frustration comes from the people or the things we interact with. And, you know, one minute you could say, oh, you know, my husband, he forgot to do this and he didn't do that, he didn't remember this, and you're like looking at all these negative things that he never and he always and he didn't. And then something happens where, you know, whether it's a friend or a situation where something outside of yourself occurs, and you all of a sudden say, wait a minute, maybe he doesn't take out the garbage, and maybe he always forgets to, you know, whatever, remind me about, but he's a good, kind, honest, hardworking, loving, considerate, you know, and all of a sudden your mind completely flips, and you start listing all the good things, and you say, you know what, those things that really were eating me up an hour ago, they don't matter right now, this is more important. So we all, I'm sure, could probably go around and share some time in our life where we were very upset with whatever it is, our child, our spouse, our coworker, our boss, and all of a sudden something occurred in our mind, usually, or in an outside circumstance, that made us view that exact person or scenario in a completely different light. And we know when those things happen, really, I always say, like, take note and write it down, because we need those things to remind ourselves when we're in that little black pit where, you know, we all get into it sometimes. When you're in it, everything just gets darker and gloomier, and you get grumpier and moodier, and anything anyone does or says only feeds the black fire. And that's it. You can't do anything right. What's wrong? Oh, you're asking now. Or, you know, or is everything okay? Oh, yeah, right. Like, meanwhile, you're upset because he never asked if anything was wrong in the first place. But, like, then he asked, and it was too late because, you know, I've been grumpy for 2 hours, and you're just, you know, we can go into these scenarios, and we're all laughing, like, ha, ha, ha. Right. It's not so funny when you're really there, and you're really grumpy over some ridiculous thing, in hindsight ridiculous, but at that point really fundamentally serious to everything that matters in the world. And all of a sudden, something happens where you say, you know what, this is ridiculous. Like, I'm upset because it's my birthday and someone, like, forgot to get, you know, big deal. Like, in the grand scheme of things, I'm lucky I have someone who I could even be upset at that forgot my birthday. Or whatever, you know, everybody has their own, you know, then there's the at the end of the day, it's like, what can we do to help ourselves? Open our eyes in our own lives of when these things happen, write them down and read them. Because you can hear everyone else tell you, oh, when this happens, I do this, and different things work for different people. But what I would say, and I do myself, is anytime you're in a situation where things seem really not cool, and all of a sudden they change and someone switches the light on, write it down so you know what happened, what thoughts, because it's usually in the mind, it's usually the moach, the brain, where you know, you're able to convince yourself why you should or should not be happy, and it all happens up here. So write it down so when you're in that mood, you know, open it up and see what, you know, what do I have to be thankful for? What do I have to be grateful for? And that thing that seems to be really irritating and really bothering you all of a sudden doesn't seem to be as glaringly, you know, important as it may have been before you looked at things in a different light. And I think without, you know, imposing, well, think this or think that, look in your own life of when you've been able to turn it around and see if you could do it more often.
And I think some of laughter was recognition.
Yeah, no, but at the end of the day, it's like, you know, you're upset because, you know, you know, someone didn't thank you for doing something, and you're walking around all, you know, grumpy, and then it's like, you know, something happens where you're able to understand, you know what, I also do that sometimes, or I did that even worse on a day. Whatever it is that sorts out in your own mind, how, you know, forgive, love, appreciate myself and, you know, to others. So write it down. It's and keep your book. It'll be like, you know, your grumpy book, and like you'll see how quickly you fill up the pages. But all, you know, and then use a highlighter for like, and then I all of a sudden realized, and you'll see there's good stuff that happened on your own. Yeah.
I have a friend, and she lives in Florida, and I live in Georgia, and we talk to each other every day. She tells me what's wrong with her. I tell you what's wrong with me. Let's stop the bellyache and what's new, and we'll just talk politics. I'll talk about something. This
right.
goes on every day. Let's stop the bellyache and talk.
So that's good. So we could all take that, the bellyache.
Yeah.
Kvetching, you're a good, you know, Jewish woman. You do what you're going to do, you know? Yeah.
I had a question. So Chassidus looks down upon depression, right? It's a very big avera, right, to be depressed. Is it because it's assuming that you're bigger, like it's an ego thing? Like it's an ego problem that we have to diminish ourselves, like who am I to be, you know, does the whole world revolve around me? But like you said, when you're in that dark pit, it's hard to see out. Yes, it is all about, I mean, it's so destructive at that time. So I was wondering, like, something specifically Hasidic that could offer this kind of light of hope, you know?
Well, I'll tell you, it's very interesting because you started out by saying, you know, is it a sin? Now, there's two, you know, in Judaism, nothing's ever so simple. You're never going to get a straight answer.
Right.
Because on one hand, you'll have many verses and many discussions in Talmudic, Kabbalistic, and mystical literature where you can see, you know, examples. For example, I'll give you one where the author of the Tanya states that if two people are in a fight, like a wrestling, you know, match, they're boxing, one guy's much bigger and stronger, and the other guy's, you know, a little wimpy chip. If the wimpy chip is happy and joyous and exuberant and passionate about life, and the big guy is like in a depressed black pit, the wimpy chip will win, because that energy and that enthusiasm will be able to, he'll be able to fight a bigger, stronger opponent who's feeling depressed. Why? Because depression drains us of energy, and joy and enthusiasm gives us energy. So that's kind of in a fight. Mm-hmm. But what happens on a, that's physical. On an emotional level, you have the same thing. When we're fighting challenges within, if we fight it with joy, we're much more likely to be victorious than we're coming from a place of depression. And on, while it is, you know, it actually in the you know, Torah portion where it lists all the different, you know, if you don't do this and you don't do that, God won't give you rain and won't get, you know, the list of all the good and bad things. The only sin that actually says you're accountable for is sadness. If you were, you know, you just wallowed in your own depression, like, freely. Not that things are bad and you take a step back and you acknowledge that they happen, you acknowledge I'm sad and I'm upset, and then you work to get out of it. Because Judaism's not a proponent of throwing things under the rug and denial. Oh, no, you're really happy. No, I'm not really happy. So Judaism, no, stop, acknowledge what is upsetting, what happened, what the, you know, destructive action, behavior, or event happened. Acknowledge it. Acknowledge how you're feeling. It's dark, it's bad. And then say, you know what? But what I need to do is get out of it. and start working, and everyone, we have our own ways, whether it means go exercise, call up a friend, call, do your things that help you get out of it after acknowledging that you're in it. But if you don't roll up your sleeves and work on it after you are, that's when the, so to speak, sin comes in. On the other hand, the very, you know, opposite, you have the same, you know, God that tells us, you know, you're going to be held accountable if you don't pull yourself out of the depression. It's the same God, we see it says that God listens and has, you know, the most love and compassion on the brokenhearted, those, you know, that are coming from a broken place. But again, the perspective that Judaism has on it is it's not a sin to be broken, because who caused that break? Or who caused that sorrow and sadness? Most often it's things outside of your own, meaning I didn't, you have people who do it to themselves, but most often it happens to us. Yeah. And God's not saying, well, you're accountable for everything happens to you. What God's saying, no, in the brokenhearted and those who life, circumstances, events have caused pain and sorrow and deep darkness, God's with us, but in order to help us out of it, not to wallow. So it's not like you're it's a sin to be depressed. No, it's destructive to be depressing, and you're obligated to do whatever you can to fight it. But you're not obligated for the fact that it's there in the first place. You're not held accountable for the fact something happened, there was a tragedy, there's a sorrow, and you're feeling it. God doesn't punish you for it. You're not like, oh, it's a sin to be upset. Okay, tra-la-la, you know, don't worry, be happy. No, that's not, Judaism's not a superficial, you know, it's good enough religion, just pretend it doesn't matter. Dark things happen to people in our lives, into ourselves. And what do we have to do? We have to acknowledge it, know where it comes from, and know there's a reason, and our job is to fight it and grow up stronger and happier and better despite the pain, but not pretend it doesn't exist. And no, we're not accountable. Chassidism teaches us on a very strong level, we're accountable with how we react to things and what we do after the fact, but not that things happen to us. So if we're in a dark place, we're not. That's not a sin. What's a sin is if we, you know, turn out the lights, light the candles, shut people out for 6 months and just, you know, I'm having a pity party here and please don't disturb me. You know, like, I'm into this. Sometimes we need to take time to recover from something. We need to kind of, you know, grow from a dark place. It's a transition. It's not something that happens at the snap of a finger. But what we're obligated to do is work. Meaning, you know, it says in Ethics of Our Fathers, we don't always have to complete the job, meaning we don't always have to be the most happy, joyous person in the world, but we're not exempt from trying. We're not exempt from rolling up our sleeves and giving it a shot to try and be happy, to try and make the best of the situation. And so that would be the Hasidic perspective, is we're obligated to work on getting out of it. Yeah.
Hi, I thought you were fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
So how would you advise someone in a state of, you know, serious persecution, God forbid, you were in a concentration camp, this is the typical example that always comes up, how would you advise, you know, your fellow folks there came to you and said, I can't bear this anymore. You know, my child's been taken away, my husband's been taken away.
Right. I would say two things. I don't have an answer. Concentration camps, I do not have an answer. That's like God, you know. I would say two things. Thing number one is if you ever hear Holocaust survivors speak, it's something so inspiring, because I've heard many speak, and of course not to say that everybody who went through the Holocaust is the most happy, joyous person, but they exude something special that we could all learn from, because through all our trials, I don't think anyone could say we've gone through something comparable on that level. I hope not. And usually, and any time I hear a Holocaust survivor speak, I walk away thinking like, wow, and I think I have, you know, we walk away, so to speak, feeling humbled. So that's what I would say. That's why I said two things. So thing number one would be, you know, to walk away with an appreciation of people who've really had it rough and saying, you know what, maybe I could apply that to my lot, which isn't as rough, and to really appreciate the fact that most Holocaust survivors, at least the ones I've heard speak, they don't seem to be the most miserable, depressed people, you know, at all. Sometimes it's quite the opposite. They have a certain appreciation of joy that they, you know, every day is really special. That's on one hand. On the other hand, I would recommend, there's a beautiful book, and there's more wisdom in it that I can ever, you know, transmit, especially on one foot in 2 minutes. It's called Man's Search for Meaning, and it's by Viktor Frankl, who is in the, you know, he went through the Holocaust, he was in, I don't know if it was Auschwitz or Birkenau or whatever, and he wrote a whole book on how he was able to especially he was a doctor beforehand, and viewing people's mind and psychology, how people had literally nothing to live for. Everything had been utterly crushed and destroyed and taken away from them. What they still had to give them that light and that hope and that meaning. It's a beautiful book, and I think there's more profound answers in there than I could just kind of spit out on their own. But there's many places and people to turn to for inspiration when we find ourselves in a, you know, in a gloomy place, to say, you know what, I can learn from someone else. I could hear what someone else has to say, and very often we can find really deep relief in kind of seeing it through someone else's eyes. Because at the time, it's always rough when you're going through something. It doesn't seem like anybody else's problems are as big as yours at the moment. No one has these specific details at this exact time, and you feel like, you know, everyone just feels like, I'm the only one with these issues. And that's why support groups are so helpful, because all of a sudden you realize, hey, there's other people going through the same chamber pot, you know, and you're able to just kind of identify, even though we're different people, we don't know each other, we have nothing in common, and, you know, I just share.
I got the Holocaust as atheists. I just recently heard Holocaust survivors speak about that horrible stories, and that's, they couldn't come to a place where they could understand how this could possibly happen to them, to their fellow man.
Well, I would say, right, it's a totally different discussion of, you know, believing or living your life in a joyous way. Meaning, I don't have anything to say to a Holocaust survivor who says, I don't believe in God, I don't understand how God could do this, because I don't understand how God could do it, and I wasn't there. So I'm like, oh, well, I have an answer to the reason why God did it. Anyone who says that, like, leave the room. Like, walk out. You don't want to hear anyone who has to tell you why it happened. Because we don't understand it. It's an utter tragedy that's not explained on any level in any way, period, end of discussion. Our job is to cry out to God and to demand this doesn't ever happen again, and to do whatever we can on a personal level to make people's lives easier. But to explain, that's not, you know, that's not our job, because we don't understand it. And if someone says, I went through the Holocaust and I don't believe, you know, it's a different topic, belief and faith. But to say, I went through the Holocaust and I have children and I rebuilt my life and I'm trying every day and struggling to live a happy life, they're doing what they need to do. I don't think God will hold them accountable for their lack of belief, but that's just my personal opinion, as blasphemous as it may seem. You know, if that's what God's going to hold them accountable for, you know. But they, most of the time, you see people who do whatever they can to really pull themselves together and make each day a reason to smile. And very often it's in our hands. You know, I tell the students all the time, they're doing these, you know, wonderful projects. If you can make your roommate smile, that's something. If you could be nice to the person in the classroom, you know, who's asking for your notes, that's annoying, that's a big thing, that's not little. You're making somebody else happy, and very often it makes all the difference to that person. So that's really what we do have control of, and we are able to impact and influence, and that's what we're obligated to try our best to do. Yeah.
That kind of brings up a question that I had too. Some people are generally more positive than others.
Right.
I mean, the same person that went through, same two people that went through the Holocaust, some comes out of it positive and some negative. Do you think, does God make us all different for a reason? Like, why is it harder for some people? Like, why are some people negative and need to work harder to be happy and positive than others, that it comes a little bit more naturally?
Well, I would go even further to say some people it comes very naturally. You have people who naturally they just have this disposition where they're always, I mean, I could see it with my own kids. I have some kids there, the sun is always shining off their face, and some kids, you know, they're much more disposed to having a complaint or a kvetch or a, it's not fair, I don't understand. It's a disposition that you see at a very young age, but you could also see it with adults. There's people who, it's a really big struggle to just smile and be happy, and they take everything really seriously, and they always look like, you know, the world's problems are on their shoulders. As I said, they always look like they just finished eating a lemon. And those people, it's a real avoda, it's a real challenge to work on being happy. We all have our challenges. For some of us, it may not be in the realm of, you know, depression versus joy. It may be in the realm of honesty versus dishonesty. I see it with kids. Some kids, they can't, everything you ask them, like, you know, who broke mommy's, oh, I did, and other kids, they never admit that they did anything. It's very natural. They're coming from the same home where we're teaching them the same values, and you have kids who are, and I'm just saying children because it's easy to see at a very young age how they're all affected by the same things. They're living in the same home with the same two parents with the same value system, and you have kids who very naturally have no problem sharing and interacting with friends and, you know, socializing, and then you have other children who, that's a challenge to interact with people just naturally, and they're shy or they don't want to talk to whoever you see. And we, God gave us, you know, what kind of world would it be if we all were working on the same issue? We all have very, very different challenges, and for some of us, it's a blessing. We're naturally happy. We're naturally just chilled, easygoing, happy-go-lucky, and that's not our avodah. That comes easy for us. What do we have to work on? Always something, but something else. And that kind of, you know, makes the world as interesting as it is, because there's no two people who have the same challenges on the same level in the same way. So, you know, if you find, wow, you know, I'm predisposed to being depressed or to get down or to just see things in a negative way, I have to really work on that. Whereas someone else, naturally, they just see, you know, see everything with rose-colored glasses, and it's a beautiful thing, and most people like to hang out with those kind of people, but it doesn't exempt us from working if that's not our strong point. So the question of why God made, you know, so it's a fact. You know, we all have different things to work on, and we need to kind of examine ourselves and say, you know, what things do I have strength? Like, what comes easy to me? Is it to go out of my way? Is it me to help people? Is it that I'm just naturally honest, that I'm naturally friendly, that I'm naturally, you know, happy, or, you know, and you could, the list can go on, and both positive and negative, and we have to kind of pick out, well, you know what, this is something I really need to work on. But what I would just add is, being happy is something that should be on that list, because very often people just think it's my own business. Mm-hmm. Meaning, honesty affects, you know, my business dealings, or, you know, this affects that, but my mood, I don't need to work on it, I'm entitled, or, you know, it's like the guy in the joke who says, you know what, like, I'm comfortable with my anger, and leave me alone, I don't need to work on it. No, we need to work on it, because it affects everyone, and if we have that understanding, then if it's something that is a challenge to us, we say, you know what, I need to roll up my sleeves, put on a smile, and fake it till you make it. Like, pretend I'm happy and at least not make other people suffer because I'm, you know, Mrs., you know, Grumpy today. So it's a challenge. Anyone?
I think it's a good thing if you're comfortable with yourself. You have to be comfortable with yourself. I have a friend who always has to have, I had a friend, people surrounding her. And I have a beach house. We were sitting at the beach one day and they're talking about how much they need people. I said, you know something? I enjoy my own company a lot of times. I feel like reading. I'll say, excuse me, and I'll sit down and I'll read. Or if the conversation gets too heavy and gossipy, excuse me, and I'll take a walk. And they said, well, you're a loner anyway. I said, I'm not a loner. I just enjoy my own company sometimes. I don't have to be surrounded by people all the time. And that's the way I feel.
That's good. Everybody, so that's not your challenge. But every, you know, it's a blessing to appreciate, you know, who you are. And everybody on their own, you know, on their own level has to kind of, you know, we're all blessed with different gifts and we're all blessed with different challenges. So things that come very easy to one person does, you know, I have my kids every week, they sing for the students. They sing, you know, a Shabbat song. And three of my kids are like the most social, outgoing. They're 150 strangers in the room. They have no problem to get up and say anything and do anything. And I have one kid who, you know, is holding onto the back of my skirt and, you know, doesn't want anyone to look at him, although he's kind of, you know, come around to the side now and even stands near the other kids. I don't push him because I'm like, that's not his thing. You know, he's great at a lot of other things. He's not Mr. Performer, and I don't expect it. And I say, you know what? God made every child, every human being different, and some people want that. You know, they feed off the crowd, they like the energy, they enjoy other people very much, they don't want to be by themselves. And then you have people who are very happy on their own, and we each have to just acknowledge, who am I? What gifts did God bless me with? What are my challenges and the things that are difficult for me that I should work on? And do our best to, you know, make a dent in that, you know, process.
But I like people, and I'm very social, but I don't feel that I have to have somebody around me all the time.
We could all learn from you. It's a good thing.
Last question. We'll do one more, if there is.
See that? L'chaim.
Thank you again. Thank you.